Hello, everybody, and welcome to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm with you every Thursday at 10 o'clock, and today is a beautiful, gorgeous, sunny Thursday morning, a crisp fall day in New York. And I'm really happy to be with all of you today. I have a great show today. My guest is Sandra Katz, and he is a self-taught fermentation experimentalist. And he's really just so much fun. And his new book, The Art of Fermentation, is a wonderful book about the real art and history behind eating fermented foods. And we're going to talk all about that in just a little bit. But before I invite him on, I want to talk to you about what's been going on this week and share with you a recipe. The recipe I'm going to share with you today is actually how to make vegetarian sushi rolls. And the reason I'm sharing this particular recipe this week, even though I know I have shared it in the past, is because we showed the movie, we screened the movie Tuesday night at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington with my Slow Food Huntington chapter. And the movie was just great. It was called Sushi, The Global Catch. And Mark Hall is the producer and director, and he joined us after the movie via Skype. And the movie was really a beautiful tribute to the art of sushi and the history and the beauty and the rituals involved in sushi. But it also was taking a real critical look at how popular sushi has become and the problems around that. The highest quality and the most desired sushi out there is the bluefin tuna. And there is just not enough bluefin tuna to support the expanding market as people in China get a taste for sushi. They expect, 11 million new sushi eaters this year alone, and it's just going to explode. And so there's not enough fish in the ocean to support the amount of sushi that the world is craving right now. So one thing that's really wonderful is to eat sushi without the fish. And that is the kind of sushi I like, because I've never been into eating raw fish. So I'm sharing this vegetarian nori roll recipe with you, and I will also give you ideas about what else you can put inside there, because the options are endless. So that's the recipe I'll be sharing with you in just a little bit. As many of you heard, I had to put my dog to sleep this past week, and that was really sad. And but this past weekend, we had buried her after she passed away, but we put a Japanese maple tree over her grave. And it's just really a nice ritual that we do here. When a pet dies, we bury it and plant a tree or a bush on top of them. And it's, just a nice way for us to remember them. And also it helps make the plant really strong and beautiful. So our Japanese maple tree will be with us for years, and it will help me remember Maggie. There's also so many other events going on, but I want to share with you last night's event that I went to. I was one of the food donors at the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food Gala, which took place at the Academy of Medicine on 103rd and 5th Avenue. And it was a great fundraiser. They do it every year, but this year seemed especially special. They were celebrating, believe it or not, the very first in the country vegetarian public school. One of the public schools in New York City now is completely vegetarian, and that is due to the work and the recipes shared by the New York Coalition of Healthy School Food. And I just think that is really exciting. Not only does it improve the school food for everybody and limit the choices to all healthier choices, but it really shows the world and shows this country that it can be done, and it can be done in a healthy way. And also, studies have shown that when kids are eating healthy food, they are more able to learn, They are less violent. There's less bullying on the playground, and they work more cooperatively. And so it's just, you know, it's very exciting. And so hopefully their galleries plenty of money so they can expand their work. You should all check out their website, the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food. And if your kids are in a public school, or actually any school, they have a wake-up morning call that you can sign up for, which are just little nutrition bites, like 15, 20 seconds every morning that goes over the PA, and your kids will just get, you know, a little bit of nutrition info. And it's not overwhelming, but it's something that they can hear every day and look forward to. And at the end of the month, the New York Coalition will give you a printout along with a recipe for the kids to all take home to their parents. So it helps involve the parents in seeing what their kids are learning. And another really important aspect of this is that it's a way of starting to role model healthy living and bringing it home. Because the kids, you know, we can talk about healthy nutrition, but if they don't start seeing it in their schools and in their homes, they're going to be missing the opportunity, because they really learn by seeing. So that's really important. Another movie that Slow Food Huntington presented at last week, that was presented by the Save Long Island meetup group, was Genetic Roulette, The Truth About GMOs. And that was just a great movie also. Jeffrey Smith will be a guest on my show next week, and actually 2 weeks. And he is, you know, just really a activist out there trying to raise awareness about GMOs. And the more you learn, the scarier it is. And you just think, where is our government? Where are the people that are supposed to be protecting us against these kind of things? Instead of protecting us, they've snuck it into our food system for the past 30 years without telling us. And we are, you know, the guinea pigs. And the increase of food allergies and disease and the health of the American public has gone so downhill. And many people link it to genetically modified foods, which are in all processed foods now. All processed foods. So unless you're buying organic, you're really eating GMO foods. And you can go on to many different websites to find out more information about that. But if you go to the Genetic Roulette website, you'll find out a lot. Proposition 37 is the big legislation that is going to be voted on this election day, or this year on election day. Proposition 37 in California, and that is a big piece of legislation that is going to decide the future for the rest of the country. So anyone you know living in California, please beg them to get out there and vote yes for Proposition 37. What else is going on? There's so many different things going on. Growing Health 2012 on October 16th. Is going to be up in Binghamton, and that's a, you know, upstate New York, but it's worth the trip if you are, if you feel like getting up there, or if you live up there. It's a really wonderful 2-day event bringing people together about farms, food, and health, and that should be a really great event. What other events are going on? Edible Escape 2012, that's on October 17th, and that's right in the city at the Angel Arenzans Foundation on Norfolk Street. And that's, you know, sponsored by Edible Manhattan, and that's bringing all kinds of foodies together, as well as wine and drinks, and it should be a really great event. So now, without spending any more time on stuff, I would like to talk to you about my recipe so that I can bring on Sandra Katz, because there's so much to talk about in fermenting foods, and the information he has is just endless, so I really want to get to that. So vegetarian sushi rolls, I've always called them nori rolls, and I worked at a restaurant back in the 70s called Arnold's Turtle. And if you've been around that long, Arnold's Turtle was a great vegetarian restaurant in Greenwich Village. And these nori rolls I learned to make there. so I can't take full credit for them, although I have gone beyond these basic ones, and I'll tell you about that at the end of the recipe. But for this recipe, you want to buy a package of pre-toasted nori. Now, if you can't find pre-toasted nori, you can buy just sheets of nori, and you can easily toast them over the flame of a gas stove. But anyway, pre-toasted nori is just easier. You're going to cook up 3 cups of organic short grain brown rice. Now, I use brown rice just because it's more nutritious and healthy. However, I'm sure you have all heard about the arsenic in brown rice and in all rice. Research has come out that if you buy organic brown rice from California, it will have less arsenic in it than from the southern states of the U.S. Also, if you rinse it first, you'll be rinsing off about 25% of the arsenic. And then if you cook it in a lot of extra water, where normally 3 cups of brown rice, I would be using 6 cups of water or 5 3/4 cups of water. Instead, use as much as you can fit in your pot. Use 12 cups of water. The more water, the more arsenic you're going to be able to boil out. And then you just boil it bring it to a boil, and then lower it to a simmer and cook it for about 40 minutes, the same amount of time you would if you were making it with the regular proportions. But then when it's ready, similar to pasta, you're going to pour it out. The trick is you have to make sure you have a colander or a strainer that has small enough holes, because you don't want to lose your rice. And then just pour it through the strainer and let the water wash away that way. And you'll be washing away a lot of the arsenic as well. You need to let it drain well, though. If the rice is too wet, it won't work well in this recipe. So I actually made it and drained it for quite a while and just let it sit out so it dries a little bit, because the rice is wetter when you make it this way. Then you want 2 onions that you're going to cut in half and then slice into thin slivers, 4 carrots grated, 5 cloves of garlic. I like a lot of garlic. A 2-inch piece of fresh ginger that you're also going to grate. And I use these little mini food processors for grating my ginger. I just find it works great. It's really fast. You're going to want some organic tamari or shoyu. I say organic because anytime you're doing anything that's soy is one of the most genetically modified ingredients on the planet, at least in this country. And so you really want to make sure that you're using organic. And if you pick tamari as opposed to shoyu, you will be keeping this recipe gluten-free. So in case you have any gluten-free people in your life, choose tamari. Then you want to also get some aji marin, which is a sweet rice wine. And you want to use a brand that is also of high quality. Eden brand is really great. You want to stay away from a brand like Kikkoman. If you look at the ingredients, it is really not sweet rice wine. They use glucose syrup. So you really have to read your ingredients in everything. I can't stress that enough. You want dark toasted sesame oil also, and that's used as a flavoring. Dark toasted sesame oil gives a lot of Japanese food and Chinese food its signature flavor. You want a 1/2 block of extra firm organic tofu, and you're going to cut that into thin strips. And then tahini and toasted sesame seeds are optional. I sometimes use tahini to help seal the sushi rolls when I'm closing them up. You can also use a little bit of the tamari, though. So you're going to start by sautéing the onion in some olive oil for about 5 minutes until they start getting soft and translucent. Then you're going to add the grated carrots, the garlic, and the ginger. And you're going to sauté that for another 5 minutes until it's all nice and soft. Then you're going to add the mirin for just a few minutes and then the tamari. And let that cook so that the mixture is really soft and well cooked. At the very end, you're going to add the dark sesame oil for taste, and that's just for taste. So, I didn't measure how much. I would guess it's probably a teaspoon, but you can just, drizzle a little bit on, mix it up, taste it, and if you taste it, that's good enough. If you don't taste it, add a little bit more. And then you're going to remove the vegetables from the pan and leave the juice behind. Really, you don't want it too juicy. You just want to leave the juice that's in the pan and just take the vegetables out. Then you're going to spread out one of the sheets of nori. And when you look at the sheet of nori, there's a shiny side and a rough side. I usually put the shiny side inside. So I'm going to put the rice on top of the shiny side. And you're going to spread 1 cup of the cooked rice out evenly over 3/4 of the sheet of nori. So I use a full sheet of nori, and I leave space at the top. So when I'm rolling it up, the rice is in the inside, and it will be rolled like a spiral. And then I have a section at the top of the sheet of the nori that's empty that I can seal with tamari or tahini. And you want to be sure to spread the rice all the way out to the edges, otherwise your nori roll on the end pieces will be really flimsy. So the way I do that is I press the rice down really hard on top of the nori. It should be so sticky that you can actually pick the sheet of nori up and the rice will stick to it without falling off. And I put one hand on the edge of the nori while I press the other hand on top of the sheet of nori really hard so that I'm getting the rice all the way out to the edge. And I use my other hand as a guide. So I'm pressing the rice right against my hand. And then you're going to add the sauteed vegetables in the center of the rice. And you're going to just add, you know, like a strip about an inch thick of, not an inch thick, an inch wide, and maybe just a 1/4 inch thick of the vegetables. And then you're going to put a thin strip of the tofu in the center of those vegetables. And then you're going to begin rolling from closest to your body where of the sheet of nori where the rice begins and roll it up until you get to the empty part of the nori roll. Then take your finger and just put a little bit of tamari or tahini on the edge of the nori and continue rolling, and that will help seal it. And then press the nori really tight. You do not need a sushi bamboo roller in order to really do this. And then just press really hard. And you cut these nori rolls into 8 pieces so that they're really nice bite size. If you cut them into 6 pieces, it's just too big a piece to fit in your mouth at one time. And so cut them into 8 pieces. If I have kids, I even try to cut them into 10 pieces. And then to make a dip, I use equal parts of water and tamari in a small dipping bowl. I put in just a drop of the mirin to sweeten it. You can put in also a drop of the sesame oil if you'd like. You can also put in a little bit of ginger if you'd like. And if you'd like, you can also put in a little bit of wasabi. And that's it. Just also think of nori rolls as a vehicle for anything else you have. I put my leftover stir-fried vegetables in the center, and I roll those up. I've put chili in the center, and I've rolled that up. I've put vegetable curry in the center, and I've rolled that up. You really can be very creative with it. You know, think of it as another vehicle if you just don't want to eat bread and you want to make a sandwich. You can put tuna salad in the center of a nori roll. If you eat that. So anyway, you can really do a lot with nori rolls, and you can also make a sweetened egg and put that in the center. So enjoy the recipe. It is posted on my website at iegreen.com, as well as all of the events that I've talked about. So check out my website. You can also sign up for my weekly newsletter. That will let you know about all the upcoming events. Okay. So now I'd like to introduce to you my guest, Sander Katz. He is a self-taught fermentation experimentalist. He wrote the book Wild Fermentation in 2003, The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods. And Newsweek called it the Fermenting Bible. And since then, he also came out with his new book called The Art of Fermentation. You know, I think that just came out this year. And it's a great book going into a little bit more in depth into fermentation, talking about some of the practices and some of the history behind it, as well as troubleshooting some of the questions that he's gotten over the past 10 years. So it's really a great book. And I'd like to introduce you all to Sander now. Sander, are you with us?
I am here. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
Oh, it's great to have you. Thank you. Your book is just amazing. I made pickles from the book this summer for the first time.
Oh, good.
And
it was
funny.
Came out?
What's that?
Were you pleased with how they came out?
We were so pleased. I served them at a party, and everybody was going nuts.
Nice.
It was really great. And the thing was also I had grown this year for the very first time golden cucumbers, which I never had seen before. I bought the seed from a biodynamic catalog, and so it said golden cucumbers. I just assumed it was the flesh was golden, you know. And out came yellow cucumbers. So these were the most gorgeous yellow pickles. It was really great. So thank you for...
It's my pleasure. And, well, you know, pickles are what really got me interested in fermentation in the first place. Just as a kid growing up in New York City, sour pickles, which are not made with vinegar. They are made by, fermenting the cucumbers with garlic and dill, in a salt water brine. And the acid is actually lactic acid that develops as a result of the activity of the lactic acid bacteria that are just present on the cucumber.
Wow. And from your recipe in your book, I think I told you I had also put some carrots in there.
Okay, great, right.
That just made the cucumbers a little bit crispier. And,
that's great.
But it was amazing just watching the mold grow and the smell. The smell in my kitchen, people would walk in and go, "What's that smell?" It was great, and it was a little scary, though. You see the mold growing, and you grow up thinking, if something's moldy, it's bad.
Right. Well, in the realm of fermentation and, fermenting vegetables, there's a certain inevitability to mold growing. I mean, the whole setup of the ferment is about protecting the vegetables from air. That's why we're submerging them under liquid. But then there's always an edge where it meets the air and where it's prone to molding. And in different culinary traditions, people have different ideas about how to minimize that. But, ultimately what people do is scrape it off if it happens and understand that the vegetables under the brine are protected.
Right, and they were.
And people do eat molds. Molds have this sort of inevitable microbial growth on our food, has been harnessed. So, people eat cheeses with molds on them. In the Asian tradition, sake and, all rice-based alcoholic beverages, as well as miso, soy sauce, amazake, all of these foods are made, harnessing the power of molds and the enzymes that are found in molds. And so we have a certain squeamishness about it, but, in reality, people all around the world have, harnessed the power of molds, for its transformative powers.
Uh-huh. Well, one thing you wrote in your book was that fermentation for you is also a health regimen. Like you eat it because I know you've been living with AIDS for 20 years, and this is a part of your health regimen. Can you explain that to us? Fermented foods help you stay healthy?
Well, first of all, let me be clear that, fermented foods are not a cure for AIDS. They're not a cure for cancer. First of all, we need to distinguish that, there are lots of different types of fermented foods. And, I don't want to argue that, coffee and chocolate are, sort of curative health foods necessarily, even though they are products of fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
The products of fermentation, which, have the most potential to be beneficial to our health, are the lactic acid fermented foods that have not been cooked after their fermentation, so that these foods contain living lactic acid bacteria. Yogurt, kefir, and certain other types of fermented milk products, sauerkraut, kimchi, sour pickles, and fermented vegetables in general, provided that they have not been pasteurized after their fermentation. A group of beverages that I would broadly classify as sour tonic beverages, including things like kvass, mabi, tepache. There's lots of examples of this around the world, but these are all examples of foods that contain living lactic acid bacteria.
We'll have to backtrack. You'll have to tell us what those drinks are, because I don't think most people know what those are.
Okay, but let me just make the broader point about the lactic acid bacteria, right, which is that, you know, we are living in a battleground. Our bodies are a battleground in what I call the war on bacteria, and it's this misguided notion that our lives would somehow be better if we could kill all bacteria. And the most vivid reflection of this is antibacterial cleansing products. Fewer people are not getting sick because everyone is washing their hands with antibacterial cleansing products.
Right.
Antibiotic drugs, which are wildly overused and which are accumulating in our water, so we are all ingesting antibiotics every day. Chlorine that's put in our water specifically to kill bacteria, but all of this chemical exposure that we have constantly, you know, means that the bacteria in our gut, which we really depend on for many aspects of our physiological functioning, are under continual assault. And so these traditional foods containing live lactic acid bacteria actually can help to replenish and diversify these populations, which enable us to digest our food better, get more nutrition out of our food, and also play a huge role just beginning to be recognized and understood in our immune functioning. So having a thriving and biodiverse bacterial community in our gut enables us to withstand bacterial infections better and enhance our overall immune performance. So, you know, whether you're in the middle of a health crisis, whether you've been living for decades with a chronic health problem, whether you feel like you're the healthiest specimen in the world, whatever your health status, there's a potential that these live culture foods actually can improve your health. So it's not about curing any specific disease. It's about improving overall health, and any of us can stand to benefit from that.
Absolutely. They also talk about the GMO foods launching into our intestinal walls and killing the bacteria that's in there, and that this kind of fermented foods can really help replenish that and help with leaky intestinal problems and things like that. Have you heard that?
Sure, a little bit. I mean, I don't know a lot about that specific phenomenon, mm-hmm. But I've heard a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about fermenting as a form of activism and a spiritual path. And as an activist myself, and I'm constantly trying to encourage people to take up ways of becoming involved and taking back our, you know, I talk about taking back our food system and speaking out. How do you connect that with fermentation?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, if we're going to reclaim our food, you know, it means, you know, not only reclaiming seeds and reclaiming agriculture and making agriculture part of the fabric of life and, supporting local farmers and the revival of, sort of agriculture in our communities all around the country and all around the world. People don't just eat the raw products of agriculture. People also eat foods that have been transformed by fermentation. I mean, it is amazing how widespread fermentation is. According to one scholar's estimate, one-third of all food that people put in our mouths, on this earth has been subjected to fermentation before we eat it. I'm sorry?
Would you say that's the same in this country, too? Or
sure,
more
you
in
think
traditional
about bread, cheese. I mean, I'll bet, mm-hmm. Where I am right now, it's 9:30 in the morning. By 9:30 in the morning, most people in the United States have eaten or drunk something fermented, if you count, you know, bread, cheese, coffee.
Wow.
Right,
okay.
There.
Uh-huh.
In large parts of the world, staple grains and starchy tubers are always fermented. Condiments that people love to put in our food all around the world almost always involve some sort of fermentation. You know, you were talking earlier about soy sauce. Soy sauce is fermented. Fish sauce is fermented. Actually, the Chinese word for the ancient Chinese word for fish sauce is ketchup. Our word ketchup actually derives from a word for fermented fish sauce. And although our contemporary ketchup is not fermented, it is based upon vinegar, which is a product of fermentation, and so is mayonnaise and mustard. But anyway, I mean, you know, people eat fermented foods constantly. So when we're talking about, you know, reclaiming our food, it's not just a revival of agriculture. It's also, you know, sort of taking back these important processes. And, you know, two or three generations ago, you know, in every family, in every community, there were people practicing fermentation. There were annual fermentation rituals that were part of preserving the harvest. And because we've been indoctrinated into this war on bacteria thinking, you know, people in our time tend to approach this with fear, to think, you know, well, I'd love to make some sauerkraut, but, you know, how do I know that I'm going to get the right bacteria growing? How can I be sure that I'm not going to end up with some pathogenic bacteria that might, you know, make someone in my family sick, might even kill someone? And so people are just paralyzed by fear.
Right. And that really is a fear, right? I mean, are there any statistics on anybody dying from fermented foods? I don't think so.
Well, at least in the realm of fermented vegetables, there never has been a single case of food poisoning reported from fermented vegetables in the United States. There are very, very few foods that you could say that about. Certainly not raw vegetables, because we hear every year about food poisoning outbreaks related to spinach, lettuce, tomatoes. You know, it's kind of one thing after another. And so, you know, there's always the possibility of incidental contamination. But if you took vegetables that have been subjected to incidental contamination like that and fermented them, basically the contaminating organisms would be overwhelmed by the indigenous population of lactic acid bacteria. And as those bacteria acidify the environment, that acidification will destroy the incidental pathogens, and this has been demonstrated over and over again. So fermentation is actually a strategy for safety. And that doesn't mean that no one's ever gotten sick from any kind of fermented food. I mean, once you're getting into you know, meat and milk, there are some more possibilities, but there are really, you know, clear and straightforward parameters for how to do these things safely.
Right. And, I mean, people get sick on all kinds of food all the time. So, you know, I think the likelihood from a fermented food is certainly less.
Yeah,
and certainly not more. Sandra, I can't believe we're already, like, halfway through the show. I need to take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you more about some of the fermenting recipes that you have in your book, okay?
Okay, great.
All right, we'll be right back, everyone. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green. My guest today is Sandra Katz, and we'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Sandra Katz, the author of the wonderful new book called The Art of Fermentation. Sandra, you with me?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So we're talking about all these fermented foods, and there's some that, you know, that really come to mind, kimchi being one of them. You know, it's a staple in Korean food, but it's really becoming more and more popular here. Can you tell us a little bit about kimchi and what is it in kimchi that's so special?
Well, kimchi could be thought of as, a Korean-style sauerkraut, although the reality is that neither sauerkraut nor kimchi is, a single fixed tradition. I mean, they both have been reinterpreted, in very, very different kinds of way. But kimchi is basically fermented vegetables, typically spicy, with lots of chili peppers and garlic and ginger and onions. Often with daikon radishes, with napa cabbage, but you know, it's made in a vast array of styles, often incorporating fish sauce and or small fish in it. But kimchi is really delicious, and you're right. I mean, I think it's really, you know, growing in popularity in the U.S.
Yeah, you know, and
sure.
In so many of the countries, I just saw the movie Sushi, The Global Catch, and they were talking about how traditionally in Japan the use of wasabi the hot spicy mustard was put in there to kind of as a protector against any E. coli or pathogens that might be in the fish.
Sure.
And I know in India also the really spicy hot chili peppers, because they didn't have great refrigeration, whatever. Those peppers would help with the bacteria and not getting sick.
Nobody had refrigeration till 75 years ago. Nobody had refrigeration.
Right.
All of these foods are strategies for preserving food without refrigeration, and the spicing always has functional benefits in terms of helping to create a selective environment that's advantageous towards the type of organisms we're trying to grow and simultaneously discouraging of other random types of organisms that might potentially start to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And sushi, you know, you bring up the example of sushi, but, you know, fresh sushi is a 20th century phenomenon, the way drinking fresh milk is a 20th century phenomenon, because these things just would not be possible without heavy refrigeration. And so traditionally sushi was a means of fermenting fish in rice in order to preserve it.
Interesting. Yeah, they didn't go back that far in the sushi movie. Uh-huh.
And there's actually a revival right now in Japan of different regional styles of nare sushi, fermented sushi.
Uh-huh.
In my book, I have recipes for a Filipino style of fermenting fish in rice, burdong ista, and also balo balo if you make it with shrimp. And I'm sorry to drop all these crazy foreign words that most of your listeners won't recognize.
And
I listed
Swedish
all those beverages
also,
before,
right?
But people eat and drink distinctive fermented foods and beverages everywhere on this earth. And so, there's a lot of, interesting examples of this, some of which have, kind of exotic names that people won't necessarily be familiar with.
Right. You also talk about a Swedish fish fermented in barrels.
Right. Sure. That's surströmming.
Uh-huh.
Which I have had the opportunity to sample, and as with many foods, the aroma that it creates, the smell of it, is much stronger than the actual flavor of it. But I think it's really important to acknowledge that fermentation creates strong flavors as well as strong smells. And you were sort of alluding to this with the pickles fermenting in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us, in our time, when people just are expecting everything to be, fresh and clean and smell fresh, the smell of something fermenting can be a little bit scary.
It was scary. People were coming in and they were looking at this bottle, this jar, and going, "You're going to eat that?"
But that's what goes into creating strong flavors. And if you uh-huh. walk into a gourmet food store and start thinking about the nature of the foods that we elevate onto this pedestal and celebrate as gourmet foods, almost all of them are products of fermentation, because fermentation creates such special flavors, and they're not always flavors that everybody will love. I think in the realm of cheese, we all can relate to this. Some of us learn to love really strong, stinky cheeses. I have a real taste for strong, stinky cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll splurge. I'll buy a chunk of cheese. I'll invite some friends over to share it with me. And what I found is some of my friends share that passion and will really enjoy the opportunity to eat a piece of cheese like that. And other people will walk into the room and the first thing they'll say is, "What died in here?" And they would never for a moment think about putting that stinky cheese into their mouths. And the world is full of distinctive fermented foods that have strong flavors that often people who are sort of not raised exposed to the flavors find really challenging.
Yeah, my husband and I are like that. He loves the stinky cheeses, and I just it's not my thing.
But you like the sauerkraut.
Uh-huh, right. I love the sauerkraut and the kimchi. Another thing that you talk about in your book that, really interested me, because, again, as someone that likes to think of myself as an activist or really concerned about global warming and climate change, you actually make a connection between, fermentation and some of the modern concerns that we deal with peak oil, climate change, and you even talk about fermentation as a way of saving energy. Can you touch on those for us?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, whenever I meet people who are living on the margins of American society without a refrigerator, fermented foods become much, much more important to them. They can't keep milk around, but they can keep fermented cheeses, hard cheeses, and even yogurt around. They can eat salami, but they can't necessarily have fresh meat around. Fermented foods are foods that, you know, people evolved over time in order to preserve food without refrigeration. So, you know, trying to imagine a future where, energy might not be so cheap and freely available, we may not all be able to, have a giant fermentation slowing device in our kitchens. We're going to become much more reliant once again on this technology of preservation. In certain foods, fermentation also dramatically reduces the amount of cooking time that's necessary. And I think a really good illustration of this would be the Indonesian soy food tempeh. So, you know, certainly with soybeans, you know, fermenting them does not enable them to preserve longer because a dry soybean is very, very stable for a good long time. But if you want to cook a soybean until it's soft enough to comfortably eat, and you still won't really be able to digest it and get the protein out of it, but that takes about 6 hours of cooking. When you make tempeh, you cook the beans for about a half an hour before you make the tempeh. Then the fermentation you could think of as a period of pre-digestion where the nutrients get broken down by the microorganisms that are fermenting it. And then after 24 hours of fermentation, when the tempeh is ready, it's typically just fried for 5 or 10 minutes. So you're taking a food that would typically take, 6 hours of cooking, and you're reducing the cooking time that's required to about 35 minutes, and that is a huge and significant energy savings, especially in a culture like you find in Java, the largest island in Indonesia, where it's a staple food.
Mm-hmm. And I love tempeh, and I always, tell people of the soy products, tempeh, I think, is the healthiest. It's certainly healthier than tofu because
it's
a fermented product.
Exactly. I mean, all of those critiques of soybeans really only apply to unfermented soy, and then once it's fermented, the whole picture changes, and all the phytoestrogen, the trypsin inhibitors, all those things are kind of removed by pre-digestion.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that I found interesting, you devote a section of your book to acorns, and I never really think of acorns as food. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a time, prior to the European conquest of the Americas, where acorns were a staple food.
I only think of squirrels eating acorns, actually.
Well, squirrels do eat acorns, but people eat acorns also, and I just like to remind people that all of the rhetoric we all have to see and hear and read about scarcity of food, and there's not enough food for everyone, and we can't possibly feed everyone without intensifying biotechnology. I think it's really important to just look around and see what food resources are just dropping from trees and not being tapped into, and I think acorns are a great example of that. And acorns require some process. The acorns of most varieties of oaks, have bitter tannic compounds in them, but it's easy to remove them, by soaking them in water and render it edible. And certainly acorn is rich and delicious. I just was talking the other day with a friend who grew up in Italy and was telling me about chestnut culture in the part of Italy that he's from. But I've only had roasted chestnuts.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that in the food culture that evolved in settlements in the chestnut forests of northern Italy, it's a staple of life, and people make all sorts of foods, using chestnut as a major ingredient, and the same is true of acorns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you go back into different traditions, and I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the U.S., because there's such a melting pot that we don't have any one strong tradition in one area that's, you know, that's really been there for so long that, you know, everything is so so mixed up that we've gotten so far away. Like when people think of, you know, what's an American food? I mean, they think hot dogs, you know, or, you know,
well,
we don't
I mean, I would only say that really that's true everywhere in the world. I mean, maybe it's more true here because, you know, America has been such a land of immigration and people come from everywhere. But if you look at, like, you know, we're talking about kimchi and kimchi having chili peppers. Well, chili peppers came from the Americas, and until 500 years ago, you know, nowhere except the Americas was there chili peppers or tomatoes. And look how intrinsic those have become to culinary traditions, you know, in the case of the chili peppers in Korea, in the case of the tomatoes, you know, imagine Italian cuisine without tomatoes. So I mean, there's been a huge amount of, you know, global mix of ingredients, and I would say that, you know, in the United States, that's really one of our strengths, is that, you know, we have people from every corner of the globe, and so we have all of these sort of, you know, resources and knowledge and diversity and the ability to sort of, like, you know, mix it up and, you know, apply the, you know, the techniques of one part of the world to the ingredients of another part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting opportunities.
You're right. You know, it's wonderful to look at it that way and to see the opportunity and the positive aspect of it. You know, I guess sometimes I'm looking at not the positive aspect of it, because so much I see people just grabbing fast food and not having any connection to cooking, and they never saw their mother cooking, and, you know, they don't remember their grandmother cooking, you know, or if they saw their mother cooking, it was out of a box.
And then a lot of people, yeah, I mean, a lot of people made the decision not to like bother learning all the, you know, labor intensive things that their mother was doing in the kitchen. I mean, mm-hmm. I know, you know, my mother and her sisters made that decision. You know, they did not want to spend the kind of time that their immigrant mother spent in the kitchen, and they had other things they wanted to do in their time with their time. And I totally recognize and sort of, you know, honor anyone's desire not to be a slave to the kitchen. But at the same time, yes, I mean, like, a lot gets lost when it doesn't get passed down to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a, you know, and there's a generation of people who are hungry, not necessarily for food, but for, you know, food that they can feel connected to and that connects them, you know, to the earth and, you know, the place that they're living.
Right. And you're so right. You know, these foods, you know, do take a long time to make. Or actually, the fermenting food doesn't take that long. It's really patience. It's just like,
yeah,
takes a month, you know, waiting to actually enjoy.
Right. But with
some
a food
of the
like sauerkraut, I mean, you spend 45 minutes chopping vegetables and salting them and seasoning them and squeezing them into jars, and then you have something that could feed you for weeks or months. So it's a, you know, it's a little investment in time, a little bit of patience, but then, you know, the rewards, you know, go on and on.
Oh yeah, it's like that for, you know, any of the canning or preserving of the foods. But, you know, when you grow your own food and make your own food, a lot of your time and energy does go towards that. And,
yes, absolutely.
You know, and it is something that I've chosen to do, but I do see why it's a challenge, you know, finding that balance.
Well, one thing is, nobody has to do all of it. You know, if we can each find a niche, you know, a way to plug back into food production, you know, having a garden, baking bread, making sauerkraut, making beer. No one person has to do all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we, you know, work on strengthening our connections with other people, building community, you know, finding people with similar interests that we can trade with,
And
you
also
know, then
do with people. When you're doing it with someone else in the kitchen, it's so much more fun.
Exactly.
Doing
I mean,
it
in
by
Korea,
yourself.
they have a very living tradition of, you know, there's kimchi season and people have big kimchi parties and, you know, families and friends will get together and do that work together. And so,
right.
And so, you know, rather than just being a sort of a burdensome, lonesome activity for one person, it's an opportunity for people to spend time together and celebrate.
Right. I love that. I love that idea. Let's talk about sourdough bread for a minute, because I know people love sourdough bread and have no idea how to make it or where would they get a sourdough starter or anything like that.
So basically, you know, up until 150 years ago, when Louis Pasteur identified yeast under a microscope and was able to isolate it and propagate it, all bread was sourdough bread. Sourdough simply means bread that is made with a mixed culture that includes yeast as well as bacteria. And the significance of this is, well, in the natural world, microorganisms are always found in communities. You never, ever, ever find singular microorganisms. You know, they exist in groupings and in communities, and then they have dynamics as communities. So basically, you know, all flour, you know, all grains that are grown are covered with a community of microorganisms, distinctive to different places, but following the same general patterns. And when you grind that grain into flour, the flour has microorganisms, but they're not active. They're dormant because all life needs water. But as soon as you moisten flour, the microorganisms that are dormant on it awaken and begin to be active. So the way you start a sourdough is simply by mixing flour and water. You want to make it into a pasty consistency that's liquid and stirrable, but thick enough to really coat a spoon and stay on the spoon. I would typically use a little bit more flour than water. Mix them together. You'll get the fastest results if you use rye flour. I would certainly always recommend using organic grain. And within a couple of days, it'll start to be bubbling, and then you just have to keep on feeding it. It becomes like keeping a pet. You have to keep on feeding it and stirring it.
You could
make bread with that, but the much easier thing to make with it is pancakes. And I like to make savory sourdough pancakes where I mix a little bit of my starter and some eggs and grate some vegetables into it, mix a little bit of cheese into it, and make pancakes.
How long did you let the sourdough starter go to use it for bread?
It's not really a question of how long. It's just a question of you need to build vigor. It takes, you know, a few feedings, but, you know, within a week you should be able to make bread from it.
And when you say feeding, you're giving it more
flour and water.
More flour and water. Okay.
Yep.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of you know, technique and particularly timing to be learned. You know, that's the great advantage of using pure yeast is it happens much faster. The mm-hmm. bread rises much faster when you're working with a community that includes yeast and bacteria. I mean, there are amazing advantages. I mean, you'll always get greater flavor complexity. You'll always get bread with denser nutrients because minerals that are present in the flour become bioavailable as a result of the bacterial fermentation. Also, sourdough bread typically lasts a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
It ages much more gracefully, but it takes a little bit more time to make, and it's not always as predictable. You sort mm-hmm. of, you know, you need to work with it a little bit before you really get a grasp of the timing, and the timing is going to be different everywhere, so it's not really something that like a book can tell you in any kind of a straightforward
right.
way.
Well, that's one of the things I really liked about the art of fermentation. The recipes were kind of suggestions, you know, and they weren't clear recipes like this much of this, this much of that. But anyway, we're just about out of time, and I would like people to be able to you know, go onto your website, and if they have a question, maybe send you an email. Can you share that with everybody?
Yeah, yeah, sure. My website is wildfermentation.com. I have links on there to all sorts of fermentation-related sites. So if you're interested in sourdough, if you're interested in learning how to make sake, if you're interested in learning how to make salamis, if you want to learn the secrets of kimchi, if you want to find heirloom yogurt culture, you know, there's just links to all sorts of resources that are out there on the World Wide Web, as well as you could order my books. And I also have a support forum where you can find answers to your specific questions. So, yeah, check out my website and check out my books.
That's great. Sandra, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so informative, and I'm sure we'll stay in touch. And everyone out there, it's been a pleasure having you join us. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll be with you next week on Thursday at 10 o'clock. Have a great rest of the week. Thanks again, Sandra. And good day to everybody. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.